You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, November 1st, 2010. I can't believe that. November 1st. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Jay Perini, whose latest book is The Passages of H.M., a novel of Herman Melville. Jay Perini is a poet, novelist, biographer, and scholar. Among his seven novels are The Last Station, the movie version of which features Christopher Plummer, Helen Mirren, and Paul Giamatti, Benjamin's Crossing, and The Apprentice Lover. He has written biographies of John Steinbeck, Robert Frost, and William Faulkner, as well as The Promised Land, 13 books that changed America, and The Art of Teaching, which is based on his columns in the Chronicle of Higher Education. In addition to teaching at Middlebury College and writing, he has appeared frequently on various programs for NPR, C-SPAN, and CBS, and now The Radiator. It's to add that to his CV. His latest book, The Passages of H.M., published by Doubleday, will be available in stores and online tomorrow, November 2nd. When I spoke to Jay Perini last Monday, I asked him if Herman Melville was an important influence in his writing life and if Melville was one of his favorite writers.
I've been reading Melville for 40 years. I think in fact, I was realizing just the other day as I was going for a walk, the very first article I ever published, and I've published hundreds and hundreds of articles, was a review of a scholarly book about Melville's poem, Clarel. Oh. And I published it in 1972 or 3, when I was about 22 and 23, in a little Scottish journal. So obviously I was interested in Melville even back when I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. So Melville's one of those authors that people usually catch on to quite early. You know, everybody reads Billy Budd or something like that, or Bartleby the Scrivener, I think I read when I was in about ninth grade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been interested in Melville much of my life, but I wouldn't say I was an obsessive Melvillian. You know, I've been more interested in Robert Frost, for example, and many poets than Melville. Mm-hmm. But lately, I started going back to Melville, and obviously, when I decided to write this book, I simply dived right into the work again and read everything.
So was it his work that interested you the most, or did you know a lot about his life and that you found very... I mean, because he had a fascinating life.
Well, you know, I knew that his early books were memoirs, so I knew that Typee and Omu were essentially recollections of things that really happened to him out in the South Seas in Hawaii. And I'd knew Redburn, and I knew that was an account of his journey to Liverpool, mm-hmm, and to London. And so I knew he had a fascinating life, had traveled around the world, had had amazing adventures. I always was fascinated by the idea that he was kidnapped by bisexual cannibals in the Marquesas. I mean, how can you beat that? How many of us get kidnapped by bisexual cannibals?
And live to tell the tale.
Yeah, and live to tell the tale, right. So it's rare. So I thought, well, this is a rare instance of something really extraordinary. And then I always knew that the last 30 years of his life, he essentially stopped writing, except for occasional poems and little bits and pieces. And I knew he wandered the streets of Manhattan like a ghost, mm-hmm, wearing these dark glasses, cape on, big hat, walking with his walking stick, and that he was very... And I'd read memoirs about his granddaughter's memoir where she says he pushed his wife down the steps and was drinking and was sometimes an impossible man around the house. So I was fascinated by, A, the last decades of non-productivity. Mm-hmm. I was amazed by the early years of wandering in the islands and having all these adventures. I was interested in a man with such a robust energy and intelligence suddenly just drying up like this. And then reemerging with Billy Budd at the very end. Mm-hmm. So that whole trajectory of a life of writing fascinated me. And I was interested in the whole business of Melville trying to make a go of it as a writer in the 19th century when it was no easy feat. Yeah. It's no easy feat now, but it was certainly no easy feat then either.
Right, although he was surrounded by the famous writers of the time. It seems that from reading your book, I know that he knew Hawthorne and he knew... Well, he met Dickens. His wife met Dickens.
Yes, his wife met Dickens.
Her family and connections. And
right, he was in a sense surrounded by very, and also that whole Berkshire scene. Was,
right.
There were a lot of writers around who were extremely popular. Sedgwick and Catherine Maria Sedgwick and people like that.
Now, you allow two narrators to tell Melville's story, more or less, his wife Lizzie, and then H.M. himself, as he was known to his family as H.M. I wondered how you decided that these would be the perspectives through which the story would best be conveyed.
Well, I was trying to think, what's the way to tell this story? How do I get into it? And I was thinking back to the book I wrote about Tolstoy, The Last Station. And there I had all the diaries before me of eight people, who had been with Tolstoy in the last year of his life. And I thought this gave me incredible points of entry into his way of living and his mind. And so I thought with Melville, I don't have as many viewpoints I could work with. I thought the person who knew him best would have been Lizzie, his wife. And then I started doing some research on her and found out there was almost nothing. I mean, we're talking a handful of extant letters and nothing else. So we ended in a thumbnail sketch of a biography. Daughter of a famous judge, wealthy family from Boston. And her family had known the Melvilles forever. Her father, Judge Lemuel Shaw, was Supreme Court Justice of the state of Massachusetts, Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And he had been the best friend of Herman Melville's father, who died when Melville was 12. So I knew roughly the family context, the associations, who she was, but not anything about her personality. The letters revealed zero, practically nothing. So I said, well, this is a kind of a blank canvas. I can actually make her up and invent this person who's seeing Melville on a day-to-day basis for 4 or 5 decades. So that gave me an entry into him. And then I wanted to tell the story of Melville's life in a kind of third-person narrative, but very close to him. So almost him talking. So you almost get his viewpoint, but not quite. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to actually impersonate Melville. I thought that would be really presumptuous and destined to be failure. Anybody would then read it and say, oh, come on, this can't be what Melville talked like. Because you're bound to have some strange sentences here and there in a big, long novel, which don't sound like a person from the mid-19th century.
Right.
So it's hard to get that actually 100% right. And Melville probably would have been a very circuitous, occasionally ornate speaker. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to mess with that. So I did a third-person viewpoint, who's really me, writing very close to Melville's. In other words, the third-person narrator can only know things that Melville can know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of third-person, limited narration point of view.
And then did you try to imbue his voice at all with some of what you would pick up on in his journals and letters?
Yeah. I try to imitate, to some degree, to at least suggest what Melville might have sounded like.
In his head.
In his head. Because I'm sometimes quoting almost directly from bits and pieces.
Right.
Sometimes I'm really quoting, sometimes I'm sort of parodying or writing around things he said.
In talking about inventing Lizzie, mm-hmm. At one point in the novel, you say, truth requires a certain boldness of invention, a willingness to remake reality. And then also on the next page, you had John Troy say, everyone knows that the truth can't be told, not in historical writing. You have to make it up, else nobody will believe you. So it
right.
sounds like you're talking to yourself a little bit.
I am talking to myself there. Yeah. I've always thought that, in a sense, you have to make it up to make it believable. Because reality is often so bizarre you couldn't believe it. Right? The things that actually happened, if you put them in a novel, people would say, that can't be. So you have to take things down a peg to make them believable in a novel. And Melville's life was so full of robust adventure. Sometimes I'm thinking, whoa, is anybody going to believe that, 20 naked 17-year-old girls swarmed the boat when these sailors arrived in this Marquesan island and then leapt up on the deck and had sex with the sailors? But this was going on regularly. You can't imagine that going on. So it sounds like a fantasy. So it was difficult writing some of this stuff. I thought, this sounds like Perini is some kind of a nut job.
Right.
Making this crazy stuff up. But this is what really happened.
Yeah.
And these things really happened to Melville. And he really did have all these astonishing encounters with people like Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Right.
So it's really quite a story.
Yeah, it's quite a life. Now, I'm curious, as far as Lizzie's concerned, and going back to how you sort of had a blank canvas to work with, did you know, in fact, that perhaps there was tension with Melville's mother and Lizzie?
Yes, that was pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah, and anybody who ever wrote anything about the Melvilles said there was a lot of tension in the household because Herman was a mama's boy.
Mm-hmm.
And really, he was, except for the time when he was sailing, he was never without his mother at hand.
Right.
His mother, essentially, his whole married life. You know, look, they get married, they go on their honeymoon, and 10 days later, they're living in their mother's house.
Right.
And she's running the household. She's directing the meals, she's directing the housekeeping, she's in charge and says what goes on and what doesn't go on. I mean, and Maria was a tremendously domineering woman. And I think Lizzie would have been, at least my Lizzie, very shy and less willing to put herself forward and a little bit cowed by the ferocious quality of Mrs. Melville, the mother.
Mm-hmm. There was this incredibly, I thought, beautiful passage at the end of the book where his mother is being critical of Lizzie and he becomes irritated with her. And then she sort of dissolves into tears and they have this hug and you wrote that, and then all of a sudden they were mother and son again. And I just thought, I felt sympathy for Maria in that moment for the first time really in the book, because you know you do have your little boy all your life and then all of a sudden you have to change your whole way of behavior toward your child when this new situation arises. I don't know. I thought it was very well done.
The great thing about historical fiction is that nothing changes much over the decades. And so people say, how do you know what families were like in 1840? Well, because it probably was not much different in 1640 or 1240.
Yeah.
I mean, you had the same kinds of jealousies and affections and interests. The same kinds of things would have been happening.
Right.
And really, the 19th century is not so long ago. You know.
I wonder if maybe this is a good time to ask you to read something.
Sure, let me just to get, so that your listeners can get a little sense of what this, let me just read a little tiny bit here. When they're traveling with Captain Pease on the Acushnet.
Okay.
Now this was the ship that was the model for the Pequod in Moby Dick, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Toby is Herman's great friend, okay? Toby Green. And they're sailing toward the South Seas on the Acushnet, and this terrible Captain Pease is very rude to the G's, or the Portuguese sailors on board. Toby had come to dislike Captain Pease. "A right fool he is," he would say under his breath. He hoped that Herman would concur, but H.M. said nothing explicit about Pease, as it would never change anything, and he felt uneasy about disparaging an officer. In any case, Pease paid no attention to H.M. or most of the crew. It was largely the G's, the Portuguese, whom he abused in public, ridiculing their lack of English, their cowering posture, their failure to respond to his every command, however arbitrary. The men generally did not object when Pease persecuted these outsiders, who could hardly defend themselves. To many, the Azorians were a subversive and possibly threatening clique. Why did they huddle on the deck as they did, whispering in their strange tongue, snickering and winking? The songs they sang made little sense. Why could they not learn English as every other foreigner aboard the Acushnet had done? Stories about Pease, true or less true, began to circulate among the crew. His perfumed presence only added to the dark rumors, and his lack of sociability fueled the animosity that rose in flames around him, devouring his authority. Jack Hall, he's one of the first mates on board this ship, was the main source of anti-Pease gossip, and the ordinary seaman, in any case, tended to believe tales arising from an officer. "He is dangerously peculiar, I fear," said Hall one day, abaft. "We must put our heads together about Pease, or trouble will come." He leaned nonchalantly against the combing and smoked a fat cigar, addressing the third mate, Wilbur Mallon, a slight fellow from Nantucket, who stood at the helm and nodded. As ever, Hall's voice was a deep bell, and the remark drew affirming looks from a number of seamen. H.M. worried about this, as one did not say such things aboard ship without consequences. Mutiny took different forms, yet it was always a grave offense. Pease might be mad, even a little cruel, but he was no tyrant. Maybe leave it right there.
Yeah.
That gives you a little sense of just life aboard ship in the 1840s and 50s.
Yeah. And I was struck by the sort of list of captains that seemed to be incompetent or mean or just sort of somehow diagnosable.
Right.
Can you speak to that? Were they
trend? It's true that Melville took, you know, three or four major journeys, and in almost each case, the captain was either a drunk or a paranoid or a megalomaniac. So, and these kinds of captains appear again and again in his fiction.
Sure.
So it seems to me that, you know, and there were usually direct models behind each of these characters. So I had fun just portraying this crazy list of mad captains who ran the ships that Melville sailed on.
Yeah.
But the main one being this Valentine Pease, who is the model for Captain Ahab in Moby Dick.
Right. It was interesting to me that Melville was so capable of living that life and putting up with some of these personalities when he was a young man on his adventures, and yet when he was having a much more quiet and sort of maybe easier life at home, that's when he fell apart and wasn't really capable of putting up with what life had brought him.
He lived a very exciting, adrenaline-fueled life as a young man.
Mm.
4 years at sea, and probably another year at sea in the mix. So probably 5 or 6 years at sea, or traveling. He often traveled by himself. And I think these were the times when he was most alive, most himself, he was then the real Herman Melville that he wished to be.
Mm-hmm.
When he would retreat back to the family, to his wife Lizzie and the dominance of his mother, I think he grew depressed, he drank too much, and he kind of lost a grip on experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it was but of course those were the times when he was writing. I mean, he had a very ferocious stretch of writing books there for about 8 or 10 years. I mean, he wrote most of his major works, Typee, Omoo, Redburn, Moby Dick, Pierre, in a very short stretch of time. And then by 1863, when he moved to New York, he was washed out.
Mm-hmm. That's when he's in his 40s?
Yeah, he's in his 40s, and he's pretty much washed out then, in his 40s. And he gets a job finally as a customs inspector and wanders the docks, and then he retires, wanders the streets of New York, and doesn't die until, 91.
Right. It was interesting that Hawthorne said to him, in your book, you mentioned this conversation where Hawthorne says to him that he seems to write so quickly, and Hawthorne has to sort of work very hard. Work very slowly and methodically. And Melville said, this is the only way I know how to do it. And he said, well, you have to do what you have to do. And it's interesting because it's almost like the older man was sort of foreseeing that this couldn't last forever.
I think so. He saw that Melville would burn himself out with that kind of productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know quite a lot about Hawthorne and Melville just because a lot of that correspondence does fortunately exist. And also we have some of the journals of Hawthorne in which he recorded impressions of Herman Melville. We also have some of Hawthorne's wife's letters.
Okay.
Those are real letters that I quote.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some wonderful impressions of what Melville was like in his late 30s because of Sarah Hawthorne's, Peabody Hawthorne's, Sophia Hawthorne's letters. It's wonderful.
And it's interesting because she talks about how he's a very attractive man and he has amazing eyes.
Yeah.
And yet the other side of it is that it sounds like his hygiene was poor and that, depending on how close you get to him, he's either a very attractive, very unattractive person.
Well, I know. He would have been everything. He was kind of, on some level, he was would have struck many people like a homeless bum.
Mm.
He was very unkempt. He didn't keep his beard very well. His hair was long and wild. He was a bit like a beatnik, an early hippie.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the unwashed. He took baths very infrequently, so he would have smelled pretty bad. And he drank a lot, and he smoked. So he had a kind of a raw, manly, unkempt quality. And this is in opposition to Hawthorne, who would have been extremely meticulous and groomed and maybe even, I wouldn't say perfumed, but he certainly would have been very well groomed.
Right, right.
And so Nevertheless, Hawthorne, Melville would have looked very attractive if he stood at a distance. He was handsome. You look at the pictures. He's a robust, handsome young man. Mm-hmm. Really vigorous, too. You know, energetic, wild. I think he had that manic depressive side. So when he was manic and in public, he was very appealing.
Mm-hmm. At one point in your novel, Lizzie says, authors are often quite vain, I believe. I wondered where that line came from. Is that just something that you thought she would have been thinking given the surroundings of her life? Or
well, she, remember, grew up in a very elite circle in Boston. Mm-hmm. Her father was a friend of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and many, many famous authors of the Boston group. And that was the group of writers in the 19th century. I mean, Emerson and so forth. So she had seen firsthand the vanity of authors. It's all true that the chapter where Dickens comes to America, and her father played a big role in Dickens's tour of Boston. She met Charles Dickens and was completely fascinated by him, but Dickens was an incredibly self-possessed and vain man.
Right. Well, it sounds almost like his following treated him like, you know, people treated the Beatles.
Yeah, I don't think we can even think of an author today who would command the kind of rock star treatment that Dickens would have had. Mm. I mean, he was, you know, Madonna and, Bruce Springsteen rolled into one. Bob Dylan, everybody at once. So, huge following. And Lizzie, in marrying Herman Melville, kind of hoped she was marrying another Dickens, Charles Dickens. Remember, when she married him, she was taking on a guy who was a best-selling author. Mm-hmm. I mean, his first book had come out and was a huge hit. He was famous, not only in America, but abroad. I think he was much more famous in many ways in Britain than he was in America.
Mm. And he went back to Britain to try to publish, try to drum up interest in future books, because that was true.
It was true. You know, he was always trying to do that. And so I think that we can say that, you know, Melville did have tremendous fame early on, and then it faded. And the coup de grace, ironically, was his best book, Moby Dick.
Yeah.
And Moby Dick was published in 1851 to tremendous silence. You know, it got a few reviews, very uncomprehending for the most part. Melville was very disappointed that Nathaniel Hawthorne didn't take the trouble to write a big review somewhere.
Mm.
Could have made a huge difference had...
Although he dedicate the book to Hawthorne?
Yes, he dedicated the book to Hawthorne.
So would that have been inappropriate to write a review of a book that had been dedicated to you?
Well, nowadays you couldn't do it, but you know, in the 19th century that was not uncommon.
Oh, okay.
People were infinitely less worried about those things in those days. Nobody thought that a review was necessarily objective.
Okay.
So, I mean, really, Melville thought Hawthorne would write a big piece about him somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so he fell into absolute disregard. And then he published Pierre only a year later. And that book was thought to be really bad by most reviewers. One of the New York newspapers reviewed it with the headline, Herman Melville Crazy. So that shows you what they thought of it.
That was the full headline.
Full-line headline reads, Herman Melville Crazy.
Oh, my God.
And so that was it. And then so essentially Melville withdrew after that. I mean, he did write one little novel, The Confidence Man, and a bunch of stories, but that was it, really. Nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't until three decades later that he turned his hand to fiction again with The Late Burst that produced Billy Budd.
Billy Budd, yeah.
Interestingly enough, one of his greatest works.
Yeah.
Possibly his greatest.
I wanted to just back up a tiny bit. I mentioned the character John Troy, who was H.M.'s friend.
Yeah.
And you depict Melville as having fallen in love with Troy to some extent, although he felt very conflicted about these feelings. And I'm wondering, is this known to be the case that he was bisexual or at least in love with John Troy?
Whether Melville was bisexual?
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty common knowledge that Melville at least had a strong homoerotic side to him. For instance, one of the big biographies of Melville published in about 1949 was Newton Arvin's Life of Melville. And he's pretty explicit there about, he just cites all of the homoerotic passages in Melville.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read carefully through Typee, Amu, on, you see them again and again and again. There's a critic called James Creech who's written a whole book about Melville's homoeroticism. And, you know, it's everywhere in Melville's poetry and fiction. But, and if you look at, read the biographies, you see he had these endless kind of fawning attachments to younger men, such as Toby Green, when he jumped ship in the South Seas and was captured by the cannibals on the island. He had John Troy with him, and he was very taken with John Troy. But we don't know whether there was any actual homosexual activity. We just know that he had a homoerotic streak.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if he actually had any sexual contact with men, although it wasn't uncommon on whaling ships.
Right. And you make it sound like John Troy, certainly in your vision of this experience, mm-hmm. would have not been
open
to that.
I think that most of the people that Melville was attached to would not have been open to that. And so I think it was always sublimated and always just, and I don't suggest in my book that it's anything but a sublimated homoeroticism,
right. Yeah.
A sublimated bisexuality. He was certainly a practicing heterosexual, but he was probably a sublimated bisexual. And, you know, which is, you know, not uncommon, and I think made a lot of sense in reading his work. You know, finally when you get to Billy Budd, with its yearning for Billy Budd and with the endless descriptions of kind of homoerotic feeling, it's hard to say that this wasn't a kind of profound streak in Herman Melville's psyche, because he felt compelled again and again and again to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so critics have been, it's one of those things where the scholars have taken this as common knowledge, but I think it's news to most public, to the readers.
To me.
Yes. Most readers. Most readers, I think, would be shocked to discover that Melville was bisexual, perhaps, and that he had any interest in young boys.
Yeah.
I think that would have shocked them.
Now, the friend Toby Green disappeared, basically, on that cannibalistic island that resulted in the book Typee. Was he ever seen again, this
person?
Yes,
he was, oddly enough. When Typee came out, many people wrote in newspapers, this can't really have happened. Herman Melville was just making all this up. And this guy that Toby Green he writes about, who supposedly jumped ship with him and was also kidnapped by those cannibals, never existed. Well, suddenly Toby Green read this in the newspapers and came forward and said, here I am. And so he went and visited Herman Melville in Albany. And, you know, what happened was he jumped ship, he was himself got ill, and he couldn't make it back to the island in time.
Oh.
And so he was never, you know, when you think about it in those days, you know, there's no very few communications. Very difficult to you know, you can't send an email. Herman Melville wasn't
sitting. Can't text him, are you okay?
He couldn't text him or get in touch on his BlackBerry.
Right.
So it was a real, you know, so it was really a person, Toby Green. We have photographs of him, and he and Herman Melville stayed in touch for quite a long time.
Okay. Good to know. I was worried about Toby.
No, and Toby wrote letters to the newspapers saying, I'm fine, and I'm so sad that I didn't get back to help Herman, and that all is well, but it really happened because I was there.
Okay.
So he vouched for everything that was in Typee. Now, I still think that a lot of Typee is probably exaggerated or made up, but, you know, it's a blend of fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, right. The way you organize the book, we meet the older, sort of much more flawed and troubled Melville early on, and then as the plot unfolds, we get to know the younger, more carefree, curious adventurer that he was as a younger man. What was your reasoning to let us see the older man first?
Because it gives us a little bit of dramatic irony. So what I do, for instance, early on we learn that Melville, for example, didn't make any money as a writer, but then we can go to show him as a young man having this profound, wonderful dream that he will make a lot of money as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So then when we see that, it's in a context which is, you know, that's called dramatic irony to some degree. So I like the being able to sort of show us where Melville got to some degree,
mm-hmm.
and then go back and show how, you know, what he was like as a younger man, and then it kind of builds to the end where suddenly we're back in real time again. At the end of the novel,
right.
We're back in the present, and we're there. And by the time of his last voyage, all of that's conflated, and we're in real time.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're hopping around till the end, and we're suddenly in real time.
I also found it interesting, because the first chapter is from Lizzie's perspective, and I enjoyed seeing how you envisioned their courtship and marriage but getting there later was interesting, you know, because at the beginning we see that there are problems in their marriage. It's a very troubled marriage.
That's it. So you can see how it developed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, sure, and it was a complicated marriage, but by the end of the day, I hope readers will understand that it was actually quite a good marriage. In the sense they work through their problems. And I think that by the end it was a very affectionate marriage. I quote as one of my last epigraphs that wonderful poem by W.H. Auden called Herman Melville. And it talks about it, which begins, "In the end, he sailed into an extraordinary mildness." Mm. I think there was that mildness at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He had come to terms with his success and his failure. And he had refound himself in Billy Budd. And he had rediscovered himself in the marriage as what he was, you know. I think it's a very touching story in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, in Herman's mid-40s, it was a very troubled marriage.
And he lived to what, about 70?
About 70-something, 72.
Okay.
And so, you know, it was in middle age there that things went really awry.
Uh-huh.
And that's when Lizzie tried to get her brothers to kidnap her.
Is that a true story?
That's absolutely verbatim. Yes, she wrote to her two brothers in Boston and said, "Please get somebody to kidnap me and take me back to Boston."
Mm.
And they wrote and said, "That's just not possible. You know, this, if you want to leave Herman, leave him." And they were lawyers. We'll arrange for a legal separation. She said, "Oh, that would be too embarrassing. I can't do it." And that's the last that it ever came up.
Hmm. Other than Melville, and I know that there have been many, 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 because you write about them, but can you talk a little bit about some of the writers who have influenced you?
Well, you know, I've been influenced by so damn many writers.
No.
You know, I've known a lot of people,
yeah,
and I've read a lot of people. So
right.
And since I write in so many forms, I write in poetry, novels, I write criticism, I've written plays and screenplays. So I've been influenced by such a wide range of writers. It gets kind of impossible to say who's my main influence,
because
I've had so many. You know, I could say Robert Penn Warren, Robert Frost, Gore Vidal, Steinbeck, all the writers I've written about, Faulkner, and I've written about Walter Benjamin. I mean, all of these writers that I've focused on at length have been deep influences. In my own life, possibly the most influential writer has been a less-known poet called Alastair Reid, a Scot, who was my mentor in Scotland at the University of St. Andrews.
Right.
And has remained a very close friend and mentor for 40 years.
Did I read that he introduced you to Borges?
Borges.
And Neruda? Maybe?
And Neruda,
okay.
That's right. When I was a young man, about 21 years old, 22, Alistair was translating both Borges and Neruda. And they both came to Britain to meet Alistair. And then through Alistair, I met Borges and spent some time with him and Neruda.
I think I heard you speak once about the experience of meeting Borges, and there was some interaction on the beach. Did you walk
yes,
the beach with Borges?
I walked on the beach with Borges. He said he wanted to recite the Anglo-Saxon poem, "The Seafarer to the Sea." He spoke Anglo-Saxon.
Oh, my.
And he was blind, Borges, and he let go of my hand. He started walking, racing toward the sea, but he got himself turned around. He was actually standing overlooking the golf course, reciting "The Seafarer." And I was too embarrassed to say, "Borges, you're looking the wrong way." Borges and I took him out in a friend's car one afternoon. Alistair asked me to babysit Borges. And we went off traveling together down this east nook of Fife. And I said, "Mr. Borges, what would you like to do?" He said, "I'd like to go to a pub." So I took him to a Scottish pub, very basic, sawdust on the floor. And we sat in this pub, and I really, frankly, didn't know who Borges was. I didn't realize he was one of the four or five greatest writers of the 20th century.
Mm.
And I said to him, "So, Mr. Borges," he said, "just call me Borges." So, Borges, I said, "Alistair tells me you're a writer." and he said, "Ooh," he said, "Alistair's always exaggerating." And I said, "So you're not really a writer?" He said, "Oh, I've written just these little stories and a few poems." I said, "Well, have you written novels?" And he said, "No." I grew very contemptuous. I said, "You've never written a novel?" "No." I said, "Well, did you ever want to write a novel, Borges?" He said, "Jay, my dear, my whole life I dreamt of writing the great novel of the Pampas." in Argentina. And he said there would be gauchos, and there'd be prostitutes, and there would be parricide and matricide and fratricide. Generations would rise and fall. Economies would boom and bust. And he said, decades elapsed, and I never wrote this novel. And he said, then one morning I woke up, and I went to my desk, and I wrote a little 200-word review of this book. He said, that satisfied the impulse. So that was really splendid. I never forgot that. You know, Borges was a huge influence on me. I read his, then I started reading his stories and poems, and I thought, oh my God, this was just powerful stuff.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Labyrinths was great, one of the greatest collections. Ficciones, Fictions, is one of the greatest works of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Neruda was an amazing experience. Alistair took me to a reading with Neruda. Neruda was giving at the Royal Festival Hall in London, and we went. We had dinner with Neruda and went off to this reading. And it was during all the troubles in Chile. And Neruda was the Chilean ambassador to Paris at the time. And there was shouting and screaming from the audience. And a riot broke out. And in fact, in front of me, this guy was shouting horrible things at Neruda, who was trying to read his poetry. And a woman sitting next to me, in a very perfumed woman, Latin American woman, took her high heel off. The very sharp heel.
Oh, yeah.
And she brought it down with full force on the back of his head. He was a bald guy, and he bled like a stuck pig.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guards shrieked, and there was blood everywhere, and they pulled the guy away, and there was pandemonium in the place, and suddenly Neruda went up to the close to the microphone, raised his hand like Moses parting the Red Sea, and he began chanting his great poem, The Heights of Machu Picchu, in this sonorous, deep voice. And he suddenly just quelled these waves of pandemonium.
It's like he hypnotized everybody.
He hypnotized everybody, and he was a powerful figure. Neruda was one of the most impressive things. Later, I went to Neruda's houses in Chile. He had three great houses, and I went to all three of them, including this magical house he had called Isla Negra, on the south, which is about an hour and a half south of Santiago. He was dead by then, but I went to visit all three houses.
Mm.
And in each of these houses, his desk, above his desk, was the same gigantic blow-up of Walt Whitman, who was his great hero, Walt Whitman. So I was very, very. So I've retained an interest both in Borges and Neruda my whole life.
What luck to very be
lucky.
Able to meet them.
I know.
That's amazing. I've read that you enjoy writing in restaurants, and that in your life you've gone through phases where this was your habit. This is a paragraph that you wrote in your book, Some Necessary Angels, Essays on Writing and Politics. You said, restaurants provide a kind of white noise, but unlike real white noise, the sound is human. Noses are blown, people cough, you're reminded of the world of phlegm and digestion, and you feel connected. There's also a strange but unmistakable connection between cooking and writing. Writing, like cooking, is a bringing together of elemental substances for transmutation over a hot flame. It seems fitting that writing and cooking should be going on simultaneously under the same roof. I enjoyed that.
Oh, good, yeah. And it's true, and I still, every single morning, go off to a cafe or a diner, and I work.
Now, where in Middlebury is a good place to write? Is Rosie's too loud, or?
I can write either Steve's Diner or Carol's Hungry Mind Cafe.
Okay.
Those are the places I tend to go to.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't find that it's difficult to have people seeing you, recognizing you, coming over and saying, hey, how's it going?
Can be, but for the most part, people let me alone. And,
yeah.
And also, I'm pretty sociable, so I don't mind seeing people.
Mm-hmm.
I look for any excuse not to write.
At one point, you write in the passages of H.M. Of Melville, you say, if he could not attend a school, he could read and reason. More important, he could write. He knew he could write, had always known this. It was his great and wonderful secret, a private stash of self-worth. He could put into words things unimaginable except by himself. Just reading that, it just struck me as such a sort of universal experience to writers, young writers, I think, in particular, that people who write discover early on that they enjoy this, that they maybe have a talent for it, and that it's almost like a secret place they can go for comfort. And I just, I wondered if that's how it was for you.
That's exactly how it was for me, and I think it's probably for you and for every writer. You discover these are places, this is a place you can go. And you can find clarity there, you can put things in, it's this putting into words that's the work of writing. Mm-hmm. And it's very exhilarating and very reassuring. Mm-hmm. And you feel like, you know, you've always got this little secret world that you can retreat to. And it's always very reassuring. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I go there every morning, spend a long time, every day.
Have you ever had a period of time where it was difficult to go every morning?
Not really. I mean, I've had periods when I haven't written as much for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. Usually family situations or travel or something intervenes. Mm-hmm. I go through periods when I'm just feeling less energetic, maybe, and then periods when I'm writing in a blaze and doing a tremendous amount. Sometimes I'm writing a tremendous amount of poetry, sometimes not. So I go in and out of phases of writing. But I'm usually, because I write in so many different forms, I can always write a book review. There's always something I can be doing. Mm-hmm. There's enough tidying up to be done at all times, right?
Right.
The Israeli writer Amos Oz is a friend of mine. He once said to me, it's like being a shopkeeper. You go to the shop every morning, you unlock the door, and you go in and stand behind the counter, hoping there are customers. And if nobody comes, you can always, you know, dust the soup cans and, you know, see what's in the cash register and stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, I spent a lot of time dusting the soup cans. That's half my life is dusting the soup cans. And checking the till to see if there's any money in there.
Well, you got to show up in case somebody does.
Show up in case somebody comes. Right. You never know.
Yeah.
I mean, so often when I go to the cafe to write poetry, for example, I don't feel like it. But when I get there and whoa! And I'm thinking, I get a great poem and I say, well, I wouldn't have had this if I hadn't come.
Right.
So it's showing up. Right? 90% of life is just showing up. Famous line.
Yeah, right.
Woody Allen.
All right, well, in doing a little bit of research for this interview, I read Christopher Bemfe's review of the passages of H.M. Mm-hmm. that appeared in online anyway in the New Republic.
Yeah.
A great review.
Yes.
Wonderful review.
Nice.
And he writes, Perini has written elsewhere of the necessary mythos of a successful biography, the narrative arc that compels our conviction in the unified meaning of a lived life. And he goes on to say that your novels similarly use mythos in this way. So in finishing this interview, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this concept and specifically about drawing on the story of Ulysses, which you did in creating the narrative arc.
I think you always need a kind of, mythos is just the Greek word for story.
Right.
So you need some kind of a shaping story. Something that guides your writing and kind of pulls the details in a certain direction, combs the material one way and not another way. And certainly, Melville was always interested in Homer. He always traveled with his copy of Chapman's translation of Homer. And he was interested in the Odyssey in particular. And being a seaman himself, a wandering sort of fellow, he identified with Ulysses. And of course, you know, Ulysses is the story of the wandering man who eventually is looking to come home always and get back to his wife, back to that bed that was made of oak and was rooted in the earth. And I think that to some degree it's that oscillation between travel and returning that is always so important in Melville's life and in the work as well. I mean, Ishmael, the wanderings, you know, the heroes, you know, Tomo is the character in Taipei, who really stands in for Melville. These people dream of going home one day, but they're so adventurous, and they want these adventures, and they want to keep seeking new adventures wherever they can. So I think that just gave me one little kind of organizing myth for my story. It's about the setting out to the wars, going into the world, having encounters, and slaying the heads of mythical beasts, being captured. I mean, literally, sexual beasts, philosophical and intellectual beasts, fighting with the critics, were the wanderings in and out of his life. I mean, Melville did wander literally everywhere on earth. I mean, he went round and round the world many times. To the Middle East, that was a very profound trip for him. In Europe, but he always returned to his mother and to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended right there in the marriage bed. So in many ways, it's the tale of Ulysses. He's Odysseus.
Right.
The king.
Although Penelope never asked to be kidnapped.
No. Right. And right. That's because she didn't have as much to do with Ulysses as she might have, as Lizzie had to do with Herman.
That's right.
Had Ulysses made it home earlier, she might have begged for the local islanders to come and get her.
Right. Just takes her away. The hard find her, right? Okay, thank you very much for talking with me.
Well, it was fun to talk to you, Shayla.
That was a conversation with Jay Perini. Next week, tune in to hear a live interview with poet and veteran John Turner. We'll talk about his poetry and his papermaking and his participation in the group Warrior Writers, which works to help veterans transform their lives through art. Next week's show will be only my second live interview ever, and John is nice enough to be open to it, so I'm looking forward to speaking with him live at the Radiator next Monday. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jay Perini. When I asked if he had any ideas for a prompt, his answer was so eloquent and swift that I asked if I could air it in his own words. So, here it is.
If you're writing a poem, for example, it's important to have one deep image at the center of your poem. So think of an image and really try to reinforce that image with concrete details. And it works for prose as well.
Okay.
To begin with an image, see something. I always tell my students in writing prose, if you're stuck, go through the senses. Sight, smell, sound, taste, touch. The five senses. And try to make a gesture in the direction of each one of those senses. And just describe a landscape. So I'm looking out the window. I say the autumn lights lance across the field. I can smell the dry leaves with their mustiness. I can hear the leaves rattling. There's a cool breeze drawing across my skin, which I can feel. I taste a slight acidity in the air. And boom, you've got a fall scene.
Mm-hmm.
So write for the senses and create images. And remember that an image isn't just a picture, but as Ezra Pound said, it's a kind of a psychological and emotional complex moving in time.
Thank you. That's great.
Good.
That was this week's writing prompt in Jay Perini's own words. Just to recap, his new novel is The Passages of H.M. It comes out tomorrow from Doubleday. You can find out more about Jay Perini by looking at his site on Random House, and he also has a site on Amazon. A copy of this week's Write the Book prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. I'm ending a tiny bit early today, so I will put some music on in the meantime. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.